different to the path between the non-dual world and love and also Dart? It seems to be.
Well, Dart is there. You cross Dart in this path.
Yes.
Because Dart applies to all of the paths in the abyss.
So is this.
So this particular.
Yeah. Specific to that path.
Well, the conversation can happen in different paths, but where we're looking at, then we're specifically at the moment looking at this whole. So the tonality of this conversation is the movement from will to the non-dual love. Next time we'll be looking at the movement from dualistic love to non-dual will. So the same process is there, but it has a different tonality. Love and the will. So it's the non-dual will,
mm-hmm.
right? So that, and then the love, the manifest. Imagine they're all in a fused place, right? So there's awareness. There's the awareness that is the awareness of the no thing, that arises as in the intention, and from that intention, the desire, the loving quality that generates all the forms emerges. So the will is primary, the love is that which emerges in relationship to duality, in relationship to the beloved forms that are generated.
Mm.
But love without will becomes locked in form. Will without love becomes creates a world of with no connection.
Understanding is that in the similar way that in the Nefesh, Yesod's got quite a vortex to it.
Yeah.
That Dart has the same.
Yes, it also has a vortex, yeah. And what's interesting, I think, and what he does in this poem is right, as even as we enter into the nefesh, we have to return to the contemplation, Neshama, you have to return to the contemplation of the nefesh. Because you're meeting, because actually, in a certain sense, even though, if you like, with all those other processes, the energy of the nefesh, the yesodic energy, is very attenuated, it is still there. And as we start to enter into the experience of the non-dual, there's a way in which that Lilith nefesh energy then tries to kind of capture the non-dual and create a simulacrum of that in the abyss. Because the thing about the abyss, right, and the thing about the abyss is the place of survival of that sense of the constructed self. So what so when we talk about the klipot in the abyss, which I was talking about last night, which are these energies of splitting, of absence of awareness, of deliberate confusion, and of hiding in shame. This is the attempt of the constructed self to survive, and therefore even to co-opt the energies of the non-dual in the service of that. So it's almost to kind of siphon off that potent kind of energy, but wrap it around, and that's what he's describing in this contemplation of Lilith, just at this point. I probably use this word you can't use anymore because of the racial overtones of it. He used the word the black brothers or the black adepts who create their crown in the abyss. Now this is a very rare thing, but it's very developed people with a very, very developed awareness that who choose not to surrender into the divine and instead to create even tapping the deeper energies, it's at the service of something that enables the continuance of their sense of separate identity. And that's one of the dangers of the path at that point, really, that actually, and that's why in this place, as you start to do that, he's invited to contemplate Lilith, the part of him that is Lilith.
Is it possible to give an example of that?
Well, right, so it yes. So when you think of some of the scandalous guru figures, who are genuinely powerful, but are not, but that power wraps around their personality because they preserve vestiges of their personality, which then become very charismatic and very powerful because they are tapping on that energy. But instead of that coming through as clearly, it becomes, it's given a twist and it magnifies their personality. And that's where, you know, a lot of the scandals, sexual scandals, you know, domination of people, that's where that kind of cultic energy comes from. It's not, I mean, sometimes people think it's just about people conning people, but actually the more dangerous thing is the genuine teacher who has that genuine contact and yet twists that into the personality, because actually it's very complicated if you come across a teacher like that, because you do experience real kind of power and kind of and change and love and at the same time there's a twist in it. I mean, Crowley uses that image of the taint. You know, if I come back, I'll just read that bit of it, because he does that bit really well, actually.
It makes a lot of sense and kind of explains how that can happen as well.
Yeah, no, completely. And it isn't that they're not a gen... It isn't not that they're gen... See, he says it rather nicely here. I beheld in thee a certain taint, even in that which I delighted. I beheld in thee the taint of thy father, the ape, of thy grandsire, the blind worm of slime. Now, that's that sense of the... I want it for myself, that kind of, and it is like that, you know, that primate thing of I'm the top primate. So that's what he's describing there. It's that desire to not, instead of union with the universe, of being top dog and being powerful and controlled. And that's that, and it's subtle. Because I mean, he describes it very well. It's because at that level, it's not obvious. But it's a subtle twist that distorts everything.
Would you include Crowley himself in those?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking that there's this thing.
Well, the thing about Crowley is that he was actually I wouldn't, you see, because if you actually, I mean, I know nobody for Crowley's personality, but he never did that. He was very open and blatant in his needs. What he didn't do, he never did hypocrisy. I mean, most of the horrible things we know about Crowley is because he's told us them himself, to be honest. So, you know, he didn't ever hide that part of himself. I'm not saying he's not a problematic person, for sure he was. But actually, he had this, you know, one of the things when you kind of get past the man's personality, and in some senses past his writing style, and trust me, as somebody who's exhaustively studied his works for the last 18 months, I'm so sick of Crowley in lots of ways, but actually underneath this, his understanding is actually very interesting and very profound. Now in this poem, it's extraordinary. I mean, this is an extraordinarily clear description of the relationship between the angel and the self. Even at this stage, this very subtle stage, it very rarely is looked at, where you're right at that edge of the non-dual, actually you've got to really look into the taints within you that are trying to survive, despite the kind of the deep place that you've got to somewhere.
When did he write that?
When? I don't know. Well, Abramelin instant with him is complicated because he does the thing in Boleskine, which doesn't really work. Well, this whole thing, the knowledge and the conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel is this thing called the Abramelin operation. He's first of all, when he's quite young, he has this house called Boleskine at on the shores of Loch Ness, which is actually has been. I think very shortly people will be able to stay there if they want to, because it's been done up. But so he did. He had a go at doing the Abramelin operation there, but it didn't work. He didn't really fulfil it. It was in his. He's an interesting guy. He actually performed his operation when he was to the. It's knowledge and conversation operation while he was journeying through the remote bits of China, and didn't use any impediment and did it all in his imagination and did it all very powerfully. Really, but when did he write this? See if there's a note to when this book is written. I don't think I know.
It feels like it was later on.
I'm not sure. I'll have to look it up. Probably, because actually, the thing about the things he calls the holy books, and it's a bit like the Book of the Law, the inspirational things that come through. He has very little understanding of some of these things, actually, because it's coming from the deeper part of himself, you know. And I think it's not a late work. I mean, it's something that accompanied him. Now, his late work really is the Book of Thoth, Magic Without Tears. What the hell is it called? Little Essays Towards Truth. Now, these are his mature works, which is a bit beautiful. But and this is not one of those. This is. Don't think I've got anything. So look at the front of the book in case it. No, it just says when the edition has been published in 1996, really. Yeah, I'll look it up then. That'd be interesting to know. Any other thoughts and questions about this? Before we break for lunch.
The image I have for this path is, you know, you were talking about Ladish yesterday and the DNA spiral.
Yeah.
So it's almost like there is a, not a twist exactly, but a spiral in this.
Yeah, it's definitely that, yeah.
It's when the spiral gets too tight.
Yeah.
Because what you're describing with these gurus are people who are connected, but in some way, well, tainted.
Well, taint, the twist is another thing, right? So it's so instead of being a free kind of flow, it's somewhat diverted and knotted into a kind of a dominating shape.
Yeah, the energy's distorted.
That's right. That's what happened. And of course, the energy's powerful, and people will feel that. And sort of, but actually, it's that. I mean, taint is a good image, or that twist is. So you get this kind of. Unsettling sense, as well as that, as well as a sense of opening, and so it's you know, we're obviously talking very subtle stuff at this level, but it's it happens quite a lot, you know, because the continual work is the work to keep dissolving, but there is a, you know, the danger really, what he's warning against at this point. Is that you quite like that impact of the force as yours, and you sort of, so instead of continuing to surrender, you build a subtle sense of self that distorts things.
I suppose it's one reason why people have gurus rather than become a guru.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the trap, you see, isn't it? I mean, in a way, that's the thing, and for the guru as well, because the guru is also trapped into that kind of relationship, rather than, you know, where
learn. Have their own guru if there's a lineage.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of people at Osho that probably not had a guru.
Well, no. That's right. So he has nobody who can tell him, look, hang on a minute, mate. You're not getting it right. Yeah, exactly. So now that's the advantage when you know, and somebody has a teacher who can say, hang on a minute. And in a certain sense, very often, a lot of these things have come about where people have broken away from initiatory lineages. Of, I think, of what's his name, Andrew Cohen, the Advaitin teacher, is a good example. He broke away from his lineage. Chogyam Trungpa was another one, actually. Although there was a lineage, he in a way, because he was in the West, he was operating autonomously and very charismatic. And again, he had nobody to say to him, hang on a minute, look at what you're doing. So I think that, you know, that's the problem sometimes. Chogyam Trungpa, the Tibetan Buddhist teacher.
What socks it?
Well, Sogyal Rinpoche. Sogyal Rinpoche was another one, actually, of that. Although, you know, he was held in a hierarchy, he just unfortunately decided to cover it up, really, rather than do anything with it, and rather sadly.
He was really
abusive. Oh, he was vile. Oh, much more so than Chogyam. No, Chogyam Trungpa was a sort of, you know, he's...
Womanizer.
Well, he was a womanizer, but he's an alcoholic. I mean, that's the thing about Chogyam Trungpa that was tragic, actually, because he was, you know, this very powerful teacher, extraordinary teacher, was also an alcoholic. And you know, he was having DTs and things, and people were saying, oh, he's having visions. He wasn't having visions, he was having DTs, because, you know, his alcoholism was so far advanced.
I wanted to thank you for that word, thou. She's so extraordinarily tender and intimate, and used to be in common usage, didn't it? I mean,
it did.
400 years ago.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, and still is in German, I think. And this thing, difference between you and now, I was sort of searching for the appropriate word, and you suggested thou, and it seems to make a connection immediately as being a.
Yeah.
It's just got a quality to it.
Well, yeah, it is. It's got that sense of intimacy, hasn't it? I mean, an immediacy.
Yeah.
So it really works, I think, as a word for holding that intent, that intention.
Christine. And I've got a couple of quotes during the thing as well. And one was,
here's
like, what's it? It's like the refiner's fire.
Yeah, exactly.
The clarity of... And also the 23rd Psalm, this idea of the companion all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Because when you're in that unplace, your mind still has to grasp things.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. No, completely.
So lift up, think of an image, think of a
yeah, and it helps, and it helps.
And then
that.
Sink down again.
Yes, exactly. That's right. It helps keep you orientated, and then, as you say, sink down again into the deeper place. Yeah. Yeah, it just helps to do that.
I would sort of suggest that being in that abyss is not as. You could be unaware that you're in the abyss.
Yes. Oh, yeah, totally.
Which kind of makes me wonder, for some reason I thought that was more like a hell realm or something where you'd be very clear that you weren't where you were meant to be.
No, the problem with the abyss is you can be, you can think you're in that, in the supernals. You can think that you're there and you, in a sense, you're building a construction for yourself. To stop that, because what happens at that point as you touch the supernals is there's a total surrender, because the non, you know, the dualistic self cannot function at that level. So that has to be laid down. But there's of course, if we're not aware of that, and if we choose, you know, so there's a subtle turning away that can happen. Where you create the abyss almost is a, then it becomes the simulacrum of the supernals. So that's why they use this image of there are no clipot in the supernals, but there is the crown of the clipot is found in the abyss, so the shadow of the supernals. And in a way that it's quite accurate, because in a sense you substitute for the light of awareness the idea of splitting, so separating. You take, instead of being present with your will, you become unaware of your will. In place of the love that sees all and delights in all, you hide in shame. You know, so that is the dynamic. If you like, that's the underneath dynamic that produces the charismatic teacher. Okay, so you preserve yourself. And sense of others. So the splitting there is, instead of becoming one with the universe, there is me and the universe, and splitting is, I can feel it, but I'm not letting go of that, even though that it's a subtle sense. I stay with that subtle sense. I don't let myself feel that I'm doing that, so I don't let myself know my will. And I hide from myself even that I'm doing that.
There must be an incredibly subtle level.
Very subtle level, but very, very subtle.
But this is when Pranti of Western Buddhist orders is having sexual experiences with his students and convincing himself that it's spiritual.
It could be. I suppose we don't really know with him where you know what level he's operating on. I don't know with him whether he was a great spiritual master, because this the particular bits that we're looking at here, is when somebody is a great spiritual. The Western Buddhist guy is clearly was a brilliant Buddhist. Whether or not he was an accomplished adept teacher, I don't know. Well, just because I don't know him, but this is something that applies to some people with significant spiritual achievements, right? Yeah. Not just cognitive, not just because this is really a danger. If you like, that happens right on the edge of really kind of letting go, where you can really kind of pull back from that final kind of surrender into something that looks like surrender but isn't. It is the opposite of surrender somewhere.
Thing, but not like a mirage of a very known thing, like the Hall of Records or something, and you think, oh, that's where I am.
Well, it will never look like the abyss, right? That's the point of the abyss. The abyss is a disruption of consciousness. Now, and the art of bridging the abyss is to be in that disruption and to allow yourself to be disrupted and to give yourself to the angel in that moment. So if you're not doing that, it looks like something else. Okay. So it looks like, I got there.
Yeah.
Right? Or it looks like, yes, I'm in touch with the mind of the universe. And the key always is the sense, the attenuated sense of I and me and mine, which still persists there. To fully enter into thou, I, me and mine are laid down. Okay, let's have a break for our lunch, shall we? We've covered significant territory this morning. So if we come back about 1:45, we'll see what happens next.